From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Terry Gross is on vacation. I'm Marty Moss Cohen. On this edition of Fresh Air, we talk with two people who have both made it big in fields usually the province of the opposite gender. Edward Villela tells us how he went from a kid on the street corner to one of the most famous dancers in ballet, working with the most famous choreographer in ballet, George Balanchine. And athlete Nancy Lieberman tells us how she made it in the man's world of pro basketball. Also today, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Wayne's World, the new movie based on one of Saturday Night Live's most popular sketches. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Israeli troops are now said to have withdrawn from some of their positions around the southern Lebanese villages of Yatir and Kafra. The Israelis broke through United Nations barricades to attack Hezbollah rocket emplacements near the villages that have been firing on northern Israel. The Israelis said their operation was limited to finding and destroying the rocket launchers. Lebanon's coastal highway was said to be jammed by Shiite Muslim militiamen heading south to fight the Israelis. Thousands of Lebanese civilians were reported to be heading north, away from the fighting. The foreign ministers of Armenia and Azerbaijan met for 7 hours today to discuss the bloody conflict in the enclave of Nagorno-Karabakh, and they agreed on the need to consider sending UN peacekeepers to the area. NPR's Mike Schuster reports from Moscow.
The fighting has intensified recently in Nagorno-Karabakh, a predominantly Armenian enclave in the former Soviet Republic of Azerbaijan. Just this week, more than 20 Armenians were reported killed there, the result of a rocket assault by the Azeri army. Today's talks were the first real negotiations on the ethnic strife since an effort last September on the part of Russia's president, Boris Yeltsin. The two sides agreed that a ceasefire in the disputed territory is necessary, and they also agreed to consider the possibility of asking the UN to send troops. More than 1,000 people have died in the strife in Nagorno-Karabakh in 4 years of sporadic fighting. The local government in the territory wants independence, but Azerbaijan claims the enclave and accuses Armenia of making a grab for the territory. I'm Mike Schuster in Moscow.
Democrat Les Aspin, the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, said today that Congress may be willing to go along with President Bush's request to build 20 B-2 bombers, five more than previously authorized. We have a report from NPR's Neil Conan.
Last year, the House voted to halt production of the B-2 at the 15 already under construction, while the Air Force was still asking for 75 of the Batwing bombers. This year, that number has been cut back to 20, and Chairman Aspin told Secretary of the Air Force Donald Rice that the committee was willing to listen if he had a good case for the additional planes. Rice testified that the 15 aircraft now on order will cost $41.8 billion, but that five more would cost just $2.6 billion extra and greatly increase operational flexibility. You've got a good case if it is $2.6 billion, Aspin said. Even though the additional aircraft would cost a relatively modest $520 million each, the enormous cost of developing stealth technology raises the price for a fleet of 20 to $2.2 billion per plane. This is Neil Conan in Washington.
Stock prices soared to a record high today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained more than 50 points to close at 3,280.64. Advances led to declines by a margin of more than 2 to 1 in very heavy trading of more than 270 million shares. This is NPR. A newly released study found that Japanese-owned factories in California paid their workers far less on average than other plants. The study also described the Japanese firms as anti-union and said they rely on low-skilled immigrant women for their labor force. The study was conducted by Ruth Milkman, an associate professor of sociology at UCLA. Milkman said that Japanese investment may be contributing to the decline of the U.S. economy because so many of the jobs at Japanese-owned factories are low-skilled and low-wage. The city of Chicago and the state of Illinois have taken the first step toward the construction of a new major airport on Chicago's southeast side. Michael Leland of member station WBEZ reports.
The agreement establishes a commitment for the city and state to work for all necessary approval for the new airport. Chicago Mayor Richard Daley predicts the facility's construction and operation will create about 200,000 new jobs in the region.
Today, February 20th, marks the start of the economic revival. of Chicago, Illinois, and Indiana.
The city and state have also agreed to form a new airport authority to oversee the new facility's operation, as well as the operation of O'Hare Field and Midway Airport, which would be closed when the new airport opens. The mayor and governor say the facility will cost around $11 billion, paid for through federal funds and a passenger tax at Chicago's other airports. The Southeast Side project has a number of opponents, environmentalists and neighborhood residents who are promising lawsuits. For National Public Radio, this is Michael Leland in Chicago.
A new survey by Money Magazine says that 37% of Americans consider themselves worse off financially than they were 4 years ago, and only 5% see themselves as better off. Money's annual Americans and Their Money survey was based on questions asked in October. At that point, more than 20% of the respondents believed that the U.S. was on the verge of depression. 55% said it was only a recession, and 20% said they believed an economic recovery was underway. This is NPR.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Edward Villella is considered one of the greatest male dancers in the history of American ballet. He began studying at the School of American Ballet at 10, and in his teens he caught the eye of master choreographer George Balanchine. That began a stormy and creative 30-year relationship between the two men. Villella was one of Balanchine's principal dancers at the New York City Ballet. He's written a memoir about his life as a dancer and his relationship with Balanchine called Prodigal Son. He described himself as a reluctant, even unlikely dancer. He was an athletic street kid. He boxed. He played baseball. He was dragged to ballet school to get him off the streets and forced to take classes after he became so disruptive. Villella tried to disguise this fact from his friends in his blue-collar New York neighborhood by wearing his baseball uniform to classes. Villella was the first male dancer to bring a physicality to ballet. He was known for jumps and leaps. I asked him if his attraction to the physical potential of dance was there from the start.
That is totally what captivated me. I was not involved in the aesthetics, nor did I even ever see a ballet in my life. But the actual physical activity was what captivated me. I would ignore the music. I was totally off the music, around it, nowhere near it. It didn't matter to me, but what mattered was the physical action itself. It was only later, when I began to have a deeper understanding of what this stuff was all about, that I connected all of those things.
When you're talking about the physicality, is that the leaping through the air, or was it the pliés and everything else?
I was not interested in the finesse of it. I was interested in the acrobatic aspects of it. I was interested in the physical challenges, the feats, the tricks in the air, the beating of the feet high above the floor, the turning in the air two and three times. Those were the things that motivated me and captivated me, simply because those were things that I had a natural ability for. I did not have a natural inclination or ability for the finesse, the quality, the foundation, the internal structure of all of this. Most people gain the internal structure and then work for the hard tricks. I had the hard tricks and felt that I didn't need the infrastructure, but that is the support upon which we are able to proceed. So it took me a long, long time before I got sense enough, got wise enough, was informed enough to realize that I needed all of it.
Why was your love of ballet such an affront to your parents?
Well, I came from a second-generation, first-generation American, Italian-American family. We were a blue-collar family. We lived in a blue-collar area of Queens. So we didn't have aesthetic pursuits as our main motivation. It was not part of our world, not part of our circle. So especially in the mid-40s, we didn't have a long tradition for classical dance in America. We didn't have an abundance of schools, theaters, companies, directors, teachers. We didn't have the external as well as internal structures to do such things.
Was it the concern that many parents have, which is literally their children cannot support themselves? They saw this as a job that wouldn't pay the bills?
Well, in those days, of course, as I said, we didn't have an abundance of companies, so it was a precarious occupation. When I first joined the New York City Ballet as late as 1957, that company was only working 5 or 6 months a year. So there wasn't a seemingly secure future for all of this. And certainly in terms of myself, as a young boy, my father was somewhat mortified that his son was in a suspect area, a suspect in terms of one's sexual preferences. My father's personal friends were two former professional prize fighters, so he couldn't understand the aesthetic pursuits that I was involved in, nor could he stand the apparent embarrassment that went along with it. So I had an awful lot of opposition going into this stuff.
I'm speaking with Edward Villella, and he's considered one of America's most celebrated male dancers, and he's just written a book about his life called Prodigal Son. You describe Balanchine, George Balanchine's relationship with his female dancers as rather complicated, rather involved relationships, very flirtatious. How would you say he treated his male dancers?
Well, Balanchine, first of all, would say to all of us that ballet is woman. He said to me way back in the late 50s that in sports, it was Mickey Mantle. In politics, it was Eisenhower. In ballet, it was woman. So needless to say, that got my attention. But one could understand Balanchine if you stop and analyze. I mean, he was fond of saying that women were so much more interesting to choreograph for because they had a number of things. They had an additional level upon which they danced. Male dancers dance on the flat foot and the half toe. Women dance on those two levels, but also on the full point. He also suggested that women had a far more flexible muscle tone, were therefore able to do certain gestures in a more expanded manner and fashion. In addition to that, partnering was developed whereby men would lift and support women, giving another choreographic possibility. So his fascination was that, along with the fact that he simply adored women, and they were the muses in his life. He was in love with these people that he choreographed for. He had formal relationships with five people, marriages, etc. You can look back at the New York City Ballet, and you can see the specific periods of the ballerinas that he adored. You look back at the Maria Tallchief period in the repertoire, you can recognize that, the Tannikeel LeClaire, the Allegra Kent, the Suzanne Farrell, etc. So he was a man who was motivated and moved by women. But by the same token, he made probably the single greatest repertoire for male dancers. So there's something of a dichotomy in all of it. But there is no question that the man was motivated by women.
Why was it so important for you to try to prove yourself to him? You call him your artistic father.
Because George Balanchine had all of the knowledge. He was the giver not only of knowledge, but he was the giver of repertoire. He was the worker of masterwork. He could mold masterwork on your own body, and he did it so wonderfully and so specifically for you as an individual. Even though he proclaimed that this was a no-star system, we were listed alphabetically, he would make a work for you, you would dance it, and the next morning you were a star. So again, there were contradictions all the time. Plus, he was a very, very abstract individual. He spoke in abstracts, but if you understood what he was abstracting from, it gave you great insight into the man.
You say he was a quick studier, or he worked rather quickly, and he would say, "Don't talk, just do."
He, I believe, felt that what his understanding was enough. He didn't need your further understanding. What he would do to the music in relation to the style, the period, the points of departure, the internetworkings, choreographically, was enough. He didn't need further comment on what he had already covered. I think that he believed that we were simply tools. We were certainly the raw material, but we didn't need to make comment beyond his comment. I had a different point of view. My point of view was I needed to know why he said those things, what was behind it, what was inside this. I needed to know the inner content. Therefore, if I digested this well enough, what would then come out of my body was a total, complete understanding. I think I have an understanding of why he didn't want us to do too much of that, because the natural inclination in human beings is to go a little bit too far with this stuff, to start chewing up the scenery, eating up the scenery, to overact, to overstate, to overdance. There's a very, very fine line. It takes a great deal of experience and investigation not to overly adorn a gesture, simply to leave it simple, to walk away with simplicity, to leave simply the essence, not the overstatement of a moment or a gesture.
How much did you have to dance through pain? And it seems whenever someone does an interview with a ballet dancer, half of the interview has to do with dancing through pain. How did you deal with it?
Well, pain became a shadow. Pain became almost a friend. Hmm. It certainly was. It went beyond enemy and got closer to being an acquaintance and almost a friend, because it was with you constantly. I very foolishly, when I first returned to dance, enjoyed the pain, because I had this foolish notion that if I ache, I must have used my muscles well and worked them real hard. So if you work real hard, you hurt. So I had this crazy, foolish notion that was right. Now, of course, we have different views of this sort of stuff, and we are prepared, and we have within our facilities dance trainers and dance medicine and masseurs and orthopedic surgeons and all of those other things. In those days at the New York City Ballet, Balanchine wouldn't even allow a masseur into the theater. He simply didn't believe in it. So we had tremendous disadvantages. And yes, pain will be part of anybody's physical activity when they overdo. And dancers have a natural inclination to overdo. It takes a great deal of background and knowledge to know just what is enough. That is great art. When you do just enough, not too much and not too little, the inclination, again, is to do too much.
Well, it was injuries, really, that forced you out of performing ballet. What was it like for you to not dance? And you describe in your book the difficulty of cooling down after a performance, the transition from one performance to the next. How did you handle not dancing?
It was very, very difficult. I said to myself when I first joined the New York City Ballet on my 21st birthday, what a wonderful beginning, but it is indeed the beginning of the end, and I should prepare for the end. Now, I don't wish to suggest that I was being very pessimistic. I was trying to be realistic, and I was trying to say to myself that in 20 years' time, I should have, over those years, had the best of a career that I possibly could have, but also prepare myself to walk away sensibly, logically, and practically. That never happened, and what occurred to me was I had a performance at the White House during the Ford administration, and I danced the Corsair Pas de Deux, and I had a tremendous pain in my leg. I danced with Mrs. Ford at the reception afterwards, went back to New York the next morning, and found out that my hip had given way, that I had worn out all of the cartilage in my hip socket. So one night I was dancing at the White House, and I was a dancer of the world. And the next day I was not only a pedestrian, but I was a pedestrian who couldn't walk. So it was an incredible shock. It was a tremendous humiliation for me, because I had lost my physicality. I had not only lost my physicality, I had lost the love and the passion of my life. But I had also lost basically my identity. And because, again, we get so captured by this stuff, we get totally enraptured with it, it becomes us. We live this world. I spent about 6 months being very, very down, and I will admit only now that I was probably deeply depressed. It took me about a year before I could go back and look at the roles that I had previously danced.
You couldn't admit that back then, how deeply depressed you felt?
No. And I think I did that subconsciously to protect myself from giving in to that depression. I think what I was doing was basically fighting that depression.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with Edward Villella, and he's one of America's most celebrated dancers, and he was a principal dancer with the New York City Ballet. He's now the founding artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, and has just written a book about his life called The Prodigal Son. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with dancer Edward Villela. You're now the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which you founded. How would you compare your style of working with your dancers to Balanchine's style?
Well, I owe a debt to Balanchine. What I learned from him, I certainly use in terms of principle and understanding and information. What I don't do is imitate Balanchine. I think imitation is practically death. I think it's still breathing, but it's basically moribund. Why imitate? I think times change, circumstances change, people change, countries change, and why should not approach to even major classical form change, even though that original approach came from a genius, the level of a Balanchine? What I did was I took all of my experience, I digested it, and then applied it as it fit contemporary circumstance and situation. So what I like to think is I was guided by my past, my background, by people such as Balanchine and Williams, but it is time now to make my own statement in my own time. This is my time now to be a director. It is decades after when I was learning about this stuff.
Well, let me read something that you said in a New Yorker profile a couple of years ago, and you said the whole art form is based on paradoxes. Your landing is your takeoff. You go down to go up. The fastest preparation is the fullest through the whole foot. You still believe that?
Absolutely. I believe that more now than ever. And those are the conclusions that I came to from these great people, from a person such as Balanchine and a person such as Stanley Williams. In these investigations, I found that really what we are about movement. That's all we are. However, we have taken normal, everyday human movement, and we have formed it, and we formed it by the positions that come out of our technical stuff. So that when we look at it, simply as pose, you begin to land. You begin to squeeze out a landing. Now you have an ending. But a variation should never end. A gesture never ends. When we stand on stage, we are moving. It is a never-ending sense of gesture, even, again, if you're standing still. So it makes logic and sense to me that when you land from a jump, the moment you get to the bottom of the jump, which to me is when the heel finally hits that stage or floor, it's time then to push up. So you don't think down in the preparation. You think you pass through down and go to the next place. So you pass through down to go up. It's full, again, of those kinds of paradoxes. For instance, we have something called turnout. We turn out our feet, but we turn out our entire body. So think in these terms. If you are making a pirouette, a turn to the right, but you are turning out your whole body, you are turning the left side of your body to the left, the right side of your body to the right, and yet the whole body goes around to the right. So again, you've got these dichotomies, and you've got to have this internal understanding, this approach to this stuff, so you don't stilt or stop gesture. You have to continue the line of movement.
You write in the end of your book that ballet is an art form that has lost its conscience. What do you mean?
Well, I think George Balanchine was indeed the conscience of the entire dance world. He was a man without flamboyant pretensions and overly adorned and all of those things. He was a man not given to great personal comforts. He didn't have limousines and chauffeurs and servants and those things. He was a man who worked. And not only that, he had a wonderful sense of integrity about the art form. He was a great entertainer, but he did it qualitatively. And so just in terms of the approach to the aesthetics of the art form, there's been no one like him before or since. And again, I think the way he presented new work just showed us new ways. He was constantly stimulating, constantly allowing us insight into the possibilities that were available. He simply illuminated the inside of the art form without, again, pretension. He was devoted to the art itself and not to the trappings that go along with it.
You describe George Balanchine as your artistic father, a man you tried very hard to please.
What was your relationship like with your own father, and how different was it from your relationship with Balanchine?
I had a lot of similarities in both relationships. My father was a wonderful man. He was gentle and he was generous and he was sensitive, but he was he drove a truck. He was a man who was involved in far more basic pursuits in life, and at one point, when my sister stopped dancing, my father said, okay, that's it. Enough of this frivolity, and especially for you, meaning me. And he said, from now on, we're going to drop this thing called ballet, and you're going to concentrate on going to college. And I was sent to a military school. And when I finished that degree, I had sneaked back the last year and started taking some classes, presented myself to Balanchine, and was offered a job. When I told him I was taking a job at the New York City Ballet, he stopped talking to me for over a year.
Really?
And it wasn't until I sent both he and my mother tickets to our second opening night a year after I had joined the New York City Ballet, and I suggested to them that if they enjoyed the performance, they could come backstage afterwards. And my father was reluctant to come, and I thought, well, maybe they wouldn't come back anyway. However, there were four ballets on that evening. Of the four ballets, I had four principal roles, and I'm sure my parents were expecting me to be lost somewhere in the back of the corps de ballet. And I guess they were somewhat stunned, if not impressed. At any rate, the evening ended, and the final curtain came down, and I was standing on the stage huffing and puffing and pouring sweat with my makeup pouring down and my wet costume. And Balanchine came on stage and started telling me what I'd been doing right and wrong, and we continued this very physical conversation. The curtain went up. It was a dark house. The stagehand came, put the nightlight on the stage, left. Balanchine and I continued our conversation. We finished. Shook hands, bowed to each other. Balanchine went off stage right. I started to go off stage left towards my dressing room, and I saw something and heard something in the wing. And there were standing my mother and father in tears. And the three of us stood on that stage laughing and hugging and crying. And from that time on, my father became a balletomane and handed out my reviews and pictures in the garment center. So there was a lovely kind of resolution to that conflict, and now I had what it was that I wanted, along with parental approval.
Edward Villela, I thank you so much for joining us today. I really do appreciate it.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Edward Villela is now the artistic director of the Miami City Ballet, which he founded a few years ago. His book is called Prodigal Son. I'm Marty Moscowane, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Marty Moscoane with Fresh Air. As a kid, all Nancy Lieberman wanted to do was play basketball. It didn't matter to her that everyone else on the court was male. She went on to make the Olympic team and become a star in women's professional basketball. But many people know her because of her relationship with tennis star Martina Navratilova. Coming up, we meet Nancy Lieberman. On Saturday Night Live, Wayne and Garth are just a couple of teenage kids who happen to have their own low-budget TV show. Now they've got their own big-budget movie, too. Film critic Stephen Schiff has a review of the new movie, Wayne's World. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. A tank-led Israeli force smashed through UN barricades this morning in search of Muslim guerrillas in southern Lebanon. Israel says its forces, backed by helicopter gunships, are looking for launchers after 3 days of rocket attacks on northern Israel. There have been reports of several deaths and injuries in the incursion, which Israeli officials say is not the start of an invasion. 4 UN peacekeeping soldiers were injured in this morning's assault. UN Secretary General Boutros-Ghali today demanded that Israel pull its troops out of the area. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Officials said 4 members of the UN peacekeeping force were injured, 2 of them seriously, during the Israeli advance this morning. The circumstances behind the shootings are still not clear. The 4 originally came from the island nation of Fiji. Boutros-Ghali quickly summoned Israeli delegate Yoram Arador to the UN this morning to protest what he called Israel's incursion. He said he viewed the recent events with grave concern, and he called on Israel to withdraw its troops and its, quote, de facto soldiers, a reference to Israeli-controlled militias in the area. Meanwhile, Lebanon was reportedly considering asking for an emergency meeting of the UN Security Council to address the Israeli action. The council issued a statement yesterday before the fighting intensified to express its concern over the latest surge of violence. At the UN, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
On Capitol Hill, the House Judiciary Committee has voted 21-12 to impose a 6-month-long moratorium on sending Haitian refugees back home. But congressional action could come too late to stop the Bush administration from returning the remaining Haitian boat people. NPR's Suni Khalid reports.
The House Judiciary Committee ignored a threatened veto today by President Bush and voted to support a bill calling for a 6-month moratorium on returning Haitian boat people. The legislation will now be sent for a vote before the full House. It could be several weeks before both houses of Congress get to vote on the measure. But unless the Supreme Court acts to block the repatriations, the remaining 5,000 Haitian refugees could be returned within 3 weeks. About 17,000 Haitian boat people have fled their country since the military overthrow of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide 5 months ago. The Bush administration says most refugees are fleeing poverty, not political persecution. About 1/3 of the Haitian refugees have been granted entry into the United States to pursue political asylum. Nearly 5,000 others have already been returned to Haiti. I'm Suni Khalid in Washington.
New claims for state unemployment benefits moved up in the latest reporting week. The Labor Department says that new claims were up by 18,000, with the largest increase in the state of California. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials climbed over 50 points to close at a record high of 3,280.64. This is NPR News. In spite of the nation's trade deficit growing in the month of December, for the year as a whole, the deficit improved to less than $66 billion. The government says an all-time high in export sales moved the trade deficit below the $100 billion mark for the first time in 8 years. But in December, U.S. exports dropped for the second month in a row. A government advisory panel has recommended that the Food and Drug Administration severely restrict the use of silicone gel breast implants, though the panel rejected a complete ban on these devices. NPR's Michael Scholar reports from Bethesda, Maryland, where the 3-day meeting on implants ended this evening.
If the FDA follows its advisory panel's recommendations, many fewer women are likely to get gel implants. Up until recently, about 150,000 women received them each year. Most of those, 80%, got them in order to have larger breasts. The FDA panel believes only those women who take part in carefully controlled studies should be able to get the implants. That could be just a few thousand. The advisory group did make an exception for women who need a breast reconstructed after cancer or an accident, or women who are born with a breast deformity. The panel said all those women should be able to get the gel implants if they want, provided they work with doctors in an FDA-approved program where the women are followed closely to check for implant-related problems. Panel members said there was no proof implants cause diseases, but said the new restrictions are needed because too many questions remain about their true risks. This is Michael Scholer reporting.
President Bush says in spite of his campaign for re-election, the U.S. will continue to be engaged around the world. Mr. Bush made his comments as he met at the White House with Sweden's prime minister. A top-ranking State Department official said later that Sweden and the U.S. agreed on all major topics, including the need to complete a new global trade agreement. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Ever since she was a young girl, Nancy Lieberman loved sports more than anything else. Guy sports like football, baseball, and basketball. Not the kind of games most young girls growing up in the 60s and early 70s played. She learned how to compete by playing with boys, and she was good. In the schoolyard, high school, and college, Lieberman played basketball and quickly distinguished herself as a great athlete. She was the youngest woman ever to play on an Olympic basketball team, which won a silver medal in 1976. She was the top draft choice in 1980 of the now-defunct Women's Basketball League. And in 1986, she was selected as the first woman to play on the all-male United States Basketball League. After meeting tennis star Martina Navratilova in the early 80s, she became her training coach and lover. Nancy Lieberman is married now and calls herself Nancy Lieberman Klein. She's written a book about her life called Lady Magic. She told me she started playing ball as a way of getting out of the house and away from her parents who were fighting all the time. I asked her what her parents and the other neighborhood kids called her when they saw her on the court.
Tomboy. She'll grow out of it. She's worse than 10 boys. The perception was, you know, Mrs. Lieberman, what's wrong with Nancy? Your daughter is in the schoolyard with all these black kids. I think you need to talk to her. I didn't think there was anything wrong with that because I was just so, you know, ingrained in just playing. And I had such a love for the competition. And I really liked, I felt a bond to the kids that I played with in the schoolyard. It was like an unconditional bond. You know, if you could play and if you could win, they accepted you.
When you played with or against boys, did they see you as a girl playing against them? Did they cut you a break at all?
No, I was just a competitor. Growing up in New York, the way it kind of shook out on the streets was you go to the schoolyard and there's just 10 or 15 players trying to get on a court, trying to play either 2-on-2 or 3-on-3. If you lose, that's it for the afternoon, basically, because if you're the smaller kids, you only had one basket. And you never get on the court with the bigger kids. So they thought and knew that I could win. And that was the common denominator there, the bond, is that I was a, you know, one of two or one of three that could stay on the floor.
When you started playing on girls' teams, how different was your style of play compared to theirs?
I think I looked rather mean because I was a very aggressive athlete. I mean, I was 5 foot, in high school I was 5'8" and could dunk a tennis ball, which is, you know, pretty remarkable for a 5'8" white girl. I was extremely physical, and most women, or I should say girls at that time, were not used to running to the basket and getting boxed out or getting a, you know, butt in their stomach or an elbow, or they weren't used to that. So I think there was a lot of animosity originally, but I wasn't going to change and bring my level to them. I wanted them to bring their level to me. And I think, you know, as we played together and they recognized, you know, I wasn't a nasty person, you know, we did get along.
When did you feel that people began to take you seriously as an athlete? And I'm thinking of coaches or even the media.
When I first came back from that USA tryout where I eventually had my ribs broken, but I was 15 years old and I went to try out, the Soviet Olympic team was touring the U.S. prior to 76, and this was in 1974, and I just went to try out. And it was the first time I took me seriously because I saw hundreds of women playing basketball doing exactly what I was doing at my ability level. And when I ended up making the cut to go to Albuquerque, and now I was getting all this media attention from all the New York newspapers and radio and TV, my mother, I mean, her attitude changed overnight. And then at the trials, I mean, when coaches are saying, Nancy, you know, we really want you to come to UCLA. We really want you to come to, you know, Yale. We really want you to come to the University of Georgia or Maryland. When you've never really thought about college before, and now all of a sudden I had 100 scholarship offers, and I'm doing interviews, you know, every couple of weeks around the country, all of a sudden you start saying to yourself, this is bigger than I thought it was going to be.
When you're playing on being the one girl on a boys' team, do you really get to see another side of them that perhaps the girls who date them don't get?
Sure, you get to see what slobs they are. No, actually, you know, in the men's leagues that I've played in, I played for Pat Riley for the Lakers in their summer league in 1980. And I have to tell you, when I first walked into the locker room, you could have heard a pin drop because they just looked at me like, you know, this lady's coming in here and she's going to take my minutes. But if you show them that you have a personality or you can laugh, and, you know, I'll tell you this quick story. I'm pretty sarcastic and I try and be, you know, funny with people. I walk into the Laker training camp and the trainer, Jack Curran, just throws his Laker purple bag at me. And I kind of caught it and he says, are you Lieberman? And I'm like, yes. He says, well, you change in there. And he's pointing to the locker room. I said, Jack, that's where the guys are dressing. And I was a little nervous, I have to tell you. And he says, well, you change in there. And I could tell right off the bat he was trying to test me. I walk into the locker room, and all these guys are just staring at me. I mean, Laker number one draft picks and guys that are trying to make it in the NBA. And I find this little area in the back, and I open up this bag, and there's like a Laker mesh jersey, and there's Laker shorts and Laker socks and a Laker jock. So I hold this thing up, and I go, yo, Jack. And everybody turns around. I go, this thing's too small. You got something bigger for me? And all the guys just started laughing. And it kind of broke the ice with them because at least they realized that I had a good sense of humor. And although we have something in common, we all are basketball players. And they've been terrific to me. I mean, they curse and talk. I mean, I could tell you the ugly part of these guys sleeping with maids and traveling on buses for 9 hours and all they talk about is what women they were with. I mean, which is just amazing to me. But, you know, for the most part, they're pretty nice guys and they treated me like I was their baby sister.
Were you able to keep up with them? I mean, were you able to play, make as many points, play defense and offense?
Well, in a women's basketball game, I'm going to score a lot of points. In a men's basketball game, I have to make adjustments because I'm not as big or I'm not as quick, but I'm more of a passer. I'm more of a conductor orchestrating my offense. My job is to make my teammates look better, get them in the right position where they need to be as a point guard. So it was more of a cerebral type of game than an actual physical game for me. And that's why I ended up lasting 2 years, because I was as good a passer as anybody in the league.
I'm speaking with Nancy Lieberman-Klein, and she was the youngest player on the 1976 Olympic team that won the silver medal. She was the first woman to play in the men's pro league, and this was in 1986. And she was also a top draft choice of the Women's Basketball League back in 1980, and she's the subject of a book called Lady Magic, the autobiography of Nancy Lieberman-Klein. We're going to take a short break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Nancy Lieberman-Klein, and she is a basketball player. Tell us how you met Martina Navratilova.
It was in 1981, And Dallas, the team I was playing for, had just lost the championship in the Women's Professional Basketball League, and I was really depressed as a competitor. And one of the girls on the tennis tour who lives in Dallas, her family was always coming to my games, and Annie's parents kept saying, "You've got to come down and watch Ann play tennis." And when I went down there, I had bumped into people like Tracy Austin and Chris Everett, because I had been to a lot of banquets and you socialize with different athletes. And somebody came up to me, Bud Collins, and Bud says, "You know, Martina, this is Nancy Lieberman." She goes, I know, I watch her play all the time. You just lost the championship game." And I'm like, "Thanks, Martina, appreciate it." And, you know, so we shook hands, and I just looked at her, and I said, "I cannot believe how small you are." And that's kind of how our conversation struck up.
Well, you say in your book that you still don't understand your relationship with Martina Navratilova.
You never know why certain things happen in your life. I mean, you certainly don't grow up as a kid and say, "You know, I'm going to have a relationship with Martina." That's going to be, you don't know these things. But, you know, when we met and we started talking and we spent some time, you know, later at the tournament, you know, you just sit there, you know, right off the bat when you hit it off with somebody or when you feel comfortable with somebody. And it was taking somebody like myself that really didn't trust anybody, I mean, my defenses were immediately down. And I mean, I just kind of felt this bond to this woman. And it was a very different feeling. It was very, you know, something that when you say you can't describe it or understand it, you don't know. You just go with it if you feel that way.
How did you work with her on her game? And as you describe it, when you first met her, she had very little discipline. She rarely ever practiced. And she didn't seem to take herself very seriously as an athlete. And this would be 10, 12, 13 years ago.
Martina had won two Wimbledons before I met her. And it just amazed me that she was able to put it together for 2 weeks and win two Wimbledons, because if Martina didn't feel like practicing, she didn't practice. And it was when I went to the French Open with her shortly after we met that I realized that, and kind of with me is what you see is what you get. And one day we're sitting in the hotel room and I just looked at her. I said, "Can I ask you a question?" And she said, "Yes." I said, "Are you going to practice today?" She said, "Nancy, we just came back from the practice courts." And I said, "Well, Martina, the way I see it is you went to the court, you hit a couple volleys, you hit a couple shots on the baseline, you talked to Billie Jean at the net, you talked to Betsy Nagelson at the net, you hit a few overheads, you hit some serves, you stretched, you shot baskets with me for 45 minutes, and here we are. You were more intent on learning how to shoot a layup than you were working on your game at practice." I said, "That just stinks." I said, "You know, this is just horrible." I said, "I'm embarrassed for you." You should have seen her face. Nobody had ever said that to her. And she ended up losing the tournament. She says, "Come on, let's go buy some jewelry." I'm like, "Jewelry? You just got your behind kicked and you want to go out and buy jewelry?" She didn't deserve any rewards. And she couldn't understand that way of thinking. And so I think that was the start of, you know, "Martina, I don't know anything about tennis, but I know how to be a winner, and I know about discipline and prioritizing. And if you'll trust me, I can help you." That's basically how our training started.
How did you try to hide your relationship with Martina from the public?
Well, you don't try and hide it. I mean, heck, I was nervous, but you try and live your life, but you know, you're doing something that's not accepted. So you really live behind closed doors and try and lead, I guess, as normal a life, if you can say that, as possible. You would never see, one thing about Martina, I mean, you're never going to see Martina in public holding hands with somebody or kissing. Martina is just not like that. It's the media that brought out the fact that she was gay. It wasn't Martina. So you just try and be respectful of others and discreet and, you know, be your public person. But when you get home, you know, be whatever else, you know, you are.
But did you find the press and others trying to pry into your private life?
Sure. I mean, people are curious by nature. And they were very curious, and, you know, but, you know, we just were steadfast that, you know, we just worked together and we were friends. And, you know, the thing about Martine and I is we're very honest people. And so you don't like to lie to people. I have a hard time looking somebody in the eye and saying, no, I didn't do that.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you are what you are. I mean, my life is night and day from, you know, 8 years ago. You know, I mean, I'm happily married for 4 years. And I think now, you know, with my Christianity and, you know, just certain beliefs, and I have a different life and a different lifestyle. But Martina was, she opened a whole new world to me. She taught me a lot. And just not only personally, but, you know, dealing with it in public was, you know, was a great learning experience.
What is your relationship with Martina Navratilova now?
We do a lot of, business together. Let me qualify that by saying I have a sports marketing company in Omaha, Nebraska. And Martina has played 3 exhibitions in the last year for my company, meaning I pay her her fee. I don't want any, whatever another promoter would pay to have Martina play an exhibition, that's what I do. And that's pretty much the extent of our business relationship. And, you know, and the other part is that we're just friends. You know, we'll, you know, see each other, talk sports, or, you know, see how each other's families are doing. So, you know, we have a good friendship, and we, you know, seem to have a better working relationship because it's by contract.
Keeps things clean, right?
Yes.
Well, you're 33 years old, and you want to try out for the Olympics in women's basketball. I assume the women that you're going to be competing against on this team are going to be in their early 20s.
Yes.
Are you in the kind of condition to play, I guess, to compete for the team and then play Olympic-level basketball?
I think what I lack more than anything is actually getting out there in game situations. But when I go to USA tryouts, whether it's Goodwill, Pan Am, I'm always, if not the top conditioned athlete. I mean, coaches right off the bat, when I walk into a tryout and they haven't seen me play, you know what I want them to say? How does she look like that? I can't believe she looks like that. She had to do some darn hard work for her body to look that hard or that strong or that cut. First impressions mean a lot to a committee. They haven't seen me play. I have no statistics to back up my hard work. So I've got to catch their eye with something. So, you know, you can bet that if I go to an Olympic tryout, I'm going to be in condition to compete.
Well, Nancy Lieberman-Klein, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Nancy Lieberman-Klein's book is called Lady Magic. This is Fresh Air. Linda Wertheimer has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Hi, Linda. What stories are you covering?
Marty, we are leading the program with a report from Michael Scholar on the continuing hearings on the safety of breast implants. Alan Tomlinson, you may remember, had a really frightening story to tell about his own personal experiences in rural Haiti and when he went out to try to do some reporting on repression and violence there against people who supported the democratically elected president who was overthrown. He's going to expand on that, tell us what he found, and we're going to take a political look to the South with David Malpas on what happens now when the campaign heads to Super Tuesday.
Thanks, Linda. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered, coming up from National Public Radio. The name of the game at Paramount Pictures these days is TV. Last Christmas, the Addams Family movie turned into a monster hit. And now Wayne's World, a film version of the Saturday Night Live sketch, is cleaning up at the box office. Critic Stephen Schiff went to find out why.
Well, I guess it's because Wayne's World is a motion picture masterpiece. Not. And if that line eludes you, I suppose I should tell you that the Wayne's World skits on Saturday Night Live are about a public access cable show that an Aurora, Illinois kid named Wayne Campbell and his best friend Garth broadcast from Wayne's basement. Or rather, his parents' basement, since Wayne still lives with Mom and Dad. As parody, Wayne's World has always worked beautifully. It captures the amazingly cheesy atmosphere of public access, and also, like the Bill and Ted pictures, it suits the Generation X mood of its fans, which isn't like any other mood the movies have ever shown us. Of all the youthful generations that grown-ups have called aimless, lazy, and undereducated, this one may be the first to heartily agree. In fact, that agreement is the whole joke. Wayne, played by Mike Myers, isn't a complete idiot. He's just smart enough to know he doesn't have what it takes to make it in the glossy TV world he and Garth have been eavesdropping on since birth. He'd like to be a successful smoothie like the people on TV, but he knows he can't even fake it. The best he can do is goof on success, as in this scene, in which he introduces us to life as he knows it.
My name is Wayne Campbell. I live in Aurora, Illinois, which is a suburb of Chicago. Excellent. I've had plenty of Joe jobs. Nothing I'd call a career. Let me put it this way. I have an extensive collection of name tags and hairnets. Okay, I still live with my parents, which I admit is both bogus and sad. But at least I've got an amazing cable access show, and I still know how to party. But what I'd really love is to do Wayne's World for a living. It might happen.
Wayne's best friend Garth, played by Dana Carvey, may be smarter than Wayne. He may even be some kind of dweeby computer nerd genius. But no one will ever know, because what Wayne lacks in sophistication, Garth lacks in social skills. He greets every new encounter with the same mute, twisted little grin, a grin that bespeaks pure terror. Clearly, these two are not ready for primetime, but primetime is exactly where the oily TV promoter, played by Rob Lowe, wants to put them. He also wants to steal Wayne's new girlfriend, a beautiful but thunderously talentless rock screecher, played by Tia Carrere. Will Lowe get Wayne's girl? And more important, will he make the boys compromise their show? Which, let's face it, is like worrying about whether low-fat milk will compromise Fruit Loops. Unfortunately, these questions never manage to be of the slightest interest. The director Penelope Spheris and her screenwriters can't seem to do anything amusing with the idea of making a slick TV product from a show founded on its host's utter inability to be slick. The movie gets pokey. And where is Wayne's World itself? We never really see the TV show all the fuss is about. The comedy of dumbness is actually one of the great strains in American movies. Look at Laurel and Hardy, for instance, or even a lot of Chaplin. There's no rule book that says that if your characters are stupid, nothing inspired can happen to them. If only the rest of the film had the wit and poignancy of the TV show's theme song, whose enchanting lyrics, well, you know them. Come on, sing along with me. Wayne's World, party time, excellent.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Okay.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and by this and other NPR member stations. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The New York Times is called America's newspaper of record. Reporter Nan Robertson worked at the Times for over three decades. And on the next Fresh Air, she tells us about the paper's abysmal record when it comes to their history of treatment of women employees. It's the subject of her new book, The Girls in the Balcony. That and more on the next Fresh Air.